You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome to the Tom Hartmann Program. It is media for the rest of us. I'm Mike Papantonio. On today's show, I'm going to have Sam Cedar, my partner in Ring of Fire, and we're going to talk about the GOP's new empathy play. I'm going to have James Kaufman. He's going to be talking about the new sweetheart deal that the DOJ just made with J.P. Morgan and some others. Bill Moyers, Joshua Holland with Bill Moyers, is going to be talking about how there is this divide taking place in this country for a lot of different reasons that we haven't thought about. He's going to talk about that. Zoe Carpenter from The Nation is going to talk about how Congress needs to step up the fight against poverty and where we are, how we've progressed since LBJ. I've got also with me Farron Cousins, producer for Ring of Fire. We're going to be just chatting about the news of the day. And I'm going to have Tom Snyder, a brilliant doctor, talking about his new book, A Physician's Apology. Farron, what we're going to be focused on today is Lyndon Baines Johnson understood that his war on poverty was certainly designed as a way for Americans to responsibly move into a part of their life where they could live with a little bit of dignity. But LBJ was also responding to the advice of talented economists, talented sociologists, who educated LBJ on the idea that the way to build a sustainable, strong economy is to begin at the bottom and then grow upward. In other words, LBJ understood that when Americans living on the margins, where that individual is struggling to provide for food and shelter for their family, a place to live for their family, just when they're just trying to get by, if you give them something, they put it back into the economy. Now, LBJ and his advisors understood that the war on poverty was also, in effect, a war to increase prosperity in this country. But then when the crazy train hit Washington, D.C., mostly during the Reagan years, intellectually dishonest conservatives, think tanks, and opportunists, they came and they told the American public that they had a new invention. They told America that their new invention was going to turn old, worn-out notions of economics on its head, and that we're even going to see greater prosperity because of their new invention. That big invention, that big lie, was called trickle-down economics. Small groups of billionaire inheritance babies who had never gone hungry a day in their lives convinced the American media to sell the American public on the idea that if we could simply give insanely wealthy individuals, wealthy corporations more money, that if we could give more money to that Grey Poupon billionaire crowd, that they were going to share their windfalls with America's working poor, and it's going to lessen the burden for taxpayers. That was the big pitch. Now, the truth is that the American media figured out that that was a lie, that it was a trickle-down fraud. They knew that 5 years into the program. Honest writers have been writing about what a lie it was 5 years into the program. But by the time the billionaire scam was in place, you had billionaires buying up the media. So the trickle-down trash argument, it could be recycled day after day in TV and radio and in print. As a matter of fact, this week we're seeing this irresponsible corporate media pitching the teabag Republican talking point that if we don't do something to take money away from workers, that it's going to hurt the worker. That's their pitch. Listen carefully to what they're going to say. They're going to say that unemployed workers would actually benefit if we take this safety net away from them. According to the outlets like CNBC and Fox, American workers have become too lazy. They become too comfortable with the table scraps that billionaires are throwing on the floor for them. And the trickle-down idea is that if we give working poor no table scraps at all, then the economy is going to spin into a new level of prosperity because those millions of what they call lazy workers who can't provide for food or clothing for their family or housing for their children, that they're going to miraculously invent some new way to generate money, and that's going to generate an increase of prosperity in our economy. That is really their argument. Listen to the argument coming from the Hill and coming from the store-bought corporate media. You've got, if you listen to McConnell, you listen to Boehner, you listen to those types, you're going to conclude that they believe that when a person is starving, that that person is somehow going to reach further down and find some character and some resource that allows them to live and launch themselves out of poverty. Since the days that that feeble, old, tired, old man, Ronald Reagan, sold his trickle-down revolution, the Republican Party and all the oddballs who still call themselves Republicans have taken on the appearance of characters that are void of decency. They're predators willing to evaluate right and wrong uniquely in terms of a dollar. They've so completely lost their moral compass, in fact, that this week the House Republican Conference had to send out a memo telling them how to act like they had empathy. The memo instructed them how you can at least fool the American public to make them believe that you have a sense of compassion. The memo really did go out. Millions of unemployed people today are going to be told by the Republican congressman that, gee, the reason they voted against extending benefits was because they were trying to help them. They have compassion. The truth is we have a better chance of gasoline dropping to a dollar a gallon than we do having a 2014 Republican even spelling empathy correctly or even spelling compassion correctly, much less understanding it. You know, I'd advise the House Republican Conference fool who sent out that ridiculous memo that they can't reinvent reality. The very reason that the people they're communicating with are Republicans in 2014 is because they have zero kinship with the average American worker. They don't understand what it's like when a person can't feed their children or have a place to live or clothe their children. For years, the Republican advisors like Frank Luntz have been trying to coach people to tell them how to act. People like Mitch McConnell and Marco Rubio. Coach them into at least giving the appearance of being a well-adjusted human being in the same way that the stripes will always distinguish the difference between a damn zebra and an extraordinary-looking stallion, the GOP in front of a politician's name is always going to separate that politician from the overwhelming majority of Americans who genuinely believe that empathy plays a part in the way we treat our fellow man, that compassion really does matter in the way that we treat our neighbor that can't afford food for his family. People like McConnell and people like Boehner, I have to tell you, if you're listening, you're always going to be a damn zebra. You'll never be a stallion. Farron, I don't know how they could make it any more bizarre, but that honestly is their pitch. They have people actually trying to instruct them and train them into how to look like they have sympathy and empathy.
But, you know, anybody who's studied psychology knows you really can't change the brain of an individual. You know, if they're born without certain traits, it's almost impossible to get those in there. And, you know, the lack of empathy, the inability to feel true human emotions is, you know, very textbook DSM-5, look it up, sociopath. I mean, this is sociopathic behavior that they can't feel, that they can't understand what they're doing.
You produced a couple of stories a couple of years ago, Farron, where you set up the scientist, you set up the psychologist that explained that, you know what, we can look at a child when they are in the sandbox, and we can tell whether they ever have a sense of empathy and compassion for the other child in the sandbox. They can tell at a very early age. And you know what? It always follows them through to when they're adults. So you can't teach empathy. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. Follow me today on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Let's have some fun. Welcome Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio sitting in for Tom today. I'm taking your calls at 866-987-8466 or 866-745-2667. And tweet me. Tweet me today at follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Let me see what you're thinking about. Let's go to some of these callers. Armin down in Bradenton, Florida. You there? Armin, are you there?
First, I'd like to commend you. You're a very brilliant man. You can't help it. You're an attorney, I guess, but you're a very brilliant man.
I guess that's a big compliment. I appreciate it, Armin. What's on your mind?
Well, usually I'm along with you and Tom's philosophical point of view. Excuse me. But on this issue, I really think, and, you know, everybody can come after me if they want, but I think the Republicans are really acting considering how broke we are and how screwed up our trade balance is. They're acting like the responsible parent here. And from time to time, you have to tell your children no.
Yeah.
They can have fits. They don't get the toy they want. I understand the big picture, but when you look at the economics, the global trade system that I don't agree with, I don't think it's free trade. It's definitely not fair trade. Any stimulant that we do now is really going to help China, and it's going to make our ditch and hole deeper. And we can't seem to have our way taking the money and the incentives away from the sociopaths in Washington, D.C. So they're not going to change.
Okay, Armin, let me respond to some of it, okay? Let me begin by responding. First of all, it's not an opinion that trickle-down economics, for example, has failed. I don't think – matter of fact, the people who helped engineer it, the very people, Stockman, who helped write it, he is the guy who actually engineered it. It came out in a book, came out in about a half dozen articles and said, you know what? We made a terrible mistake. And we can look at the history and tell we made a terrible mistake. It affected our GDP. It affected employment. It affected a prosperous economy that was turned on its head, according to David Stockman himself. He is the guy who wrote that, Armin. Second part of it, okay, you understand, what you're throwing back to me is exactly the talking point that was created by the billionaire inheritance babies that you seem to be coming to defend here. And what I mean by that is the billionaire inheritance babies said, you know, what if we can come up with a talking point to where we make people believe that austerity is good, that austerity is a place where we try to actually balance the budget, and we ignore hundreds of years of history, both here and in Europe, where we understand when government puts money into infrastructure, when they put it into schools, when they put it into broadening the base of the economy geometrically expands. Tom Hartman, and I recommend you take a look at his last book about the crash, 2016. You'll understand that a little bit better. It's hard, and I don't judge you by your lack of understanding about it. The truth is, most people don't get it because they've just simply been lied to the point to where there's no way that they can grasp the facts. I mean, if they're listening to Fox News, you're really going to listen to Steve Ducey in the morning? I mean, this guy hasn't had an original thought since he found his belly button. And so this is the kind of guy that's out there spewing those kind of facts. Let me go to Kenneth in Linton. Kenneth, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, Counselor Mike. Yeah, I think really what's going on today is really I'm not really, you know, like a preacher or anything like that, but it's a religious situation, you might say. You got to look at all the facts that goes on today. You got to look at the Bible and the facts there. You got to look at what's going on around the world today, and the politicians and everything. Especially the Republicans. I mean, they twist the truth. Exactly.
Well, can I respond, Kenneth? Let me, since we're short on time here, let me respond. Anybody that wants to understand what the heart of the idea is that we take care of the least of our brothers and our sisters can find that in Matthew 6 and Matthew 7. If you want to talk about the Bible, look there. The Beatitudes were if you take a look at the Beatitudes, they were the most important, most extensive words, if we want to talk in terms of religion here. Those were the most extensive words that Jesus ever spoke. And why did he find it important to say, clothe your neighbor, take care of your neighbor, take care of the least of my of your brothers, and I'll do the same thing for you? Why is it that we have a Republican Party that has taken the religious movement, the Pat Robertsons, and they now have Pat Robertson out there ignoring things like the Beatitudes, talking so harshly about their fellow man that you know, they have nothing in common with what those important words were trying to say. The point being here, Kenneth, is we have to understand, we have to take a look back and understand, how is it that religion became so attached to politics that we have characters like Hagee, and we have characters like Pat Robertson and Billy Graham's son, whatever that character's name is, that we have them out there saying, you know what, we're not mandated to take care of our neighbor. How has it gotten there? You see, that's the real underlying question here. And what Farron said before the break, I thought was brilliant. It has to do, you don't invent a person like that. In other words, you don't develop a personality that says, I just don't give a damn about my neighbor. You look back to that child when they were playing in a sandbox, as Farron was talking about. You look back to that child when he's in a sandbox, and you can tell how they were going to turn out just following year after year. The reason we know that is because sociologists have done that. You can't change the mind of a Marco Rubio or a Mitch McConnell. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Let's have some fun today. I'm Mike Papantonio sitting in for Tom Hartman. You know, the Republican Party doesn't see a problem with cutting unemployment benefits for millions of Americans, and they finally realize that their lack of empathy might be a big problem for them. So now they're trying to teach others in their party how to pretend, how to make believe that they have empathy, that they have sympathy for the average American worker. I'm joined now by Sam Seder, my longtime friend, and he's co-host on Ring of Fire, one of the smart folks in this business. Sam, what was your take when you saw that crazy memo that came from the Republicans trying to tell people how they can act like they have compassion?
Well, you know, it's an indication that when the Republicans went home for their break, that they got an earful from their constituents. I mean, look, this is going to cause a tremendous amount of pain for 1.4 million people as of this Saturday, who have been long-term unemployed. The number of long-term unemployed people, defined as people who have been unemployed for more than 27 weeks, is now up to about 4 million. And in about 16 of those senators' home states, you're looking at a lot of those long-term unemployed. And so they've got to figure out how they're going to walk through this minefield, because normal human beings, normal Americans, basically react to this and say, why are you punishing these people? You've got three or four people looking for every one job that's available. Why won't you help these people out? And they've got to manufacture a reason.
But Sam, listen, I mean, we've been doing radio and TV and all together for a lot of years. And we always talk about how crazy the Republican Party sometimes spins itself into. But this memo, I mean, this is a memo that is sent out trying to tell a person like Marco Rubio and Mitch McConnell how to act like they care. I mean, that's what this memo is about.
That's right.
As you point out, that we're getting killed in public perception. So let me help you. Now, doesn't this sound like Frank Luntz, when Frank Luntz said, look, you are taking on the appearance of a party completely devoid of a heart? that you're taking on the appearance of a party completely lacking understanding and compassion, and people don't like you for that. Remember that? That was the Frank Luntz pitch.
Yeah.
This is a continuation of that, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, look, the first line in this memo is, for every American out of work, it's a personal crisis for them and their family. I mean, that's pretty obvious, but they need to be told this. I mean, look, you know, Pat, they have a real problem. They have a real problem here. They have no legitimate reason, even by their own twisted logic, to deny people who are out of work and can't find work some type of a minimal amount of relief. There is absolutely no logic to it. And so the thing that the party is afraid of going into the 2014 midterm elections is that they're going to seem wildly out of touch as they actually are. And so they literally need to have their hands held and explain, well, I understand that this is actually a difficult time. I mean, and there's nothing else that they can say.
Sam, before you came on, Farron Cousins, you know, our producer, one of our producers for Ring of Fire, was with me, and he said, listen, you know, you can't teach this.
Right.
It's like trying to say we're going to take the stripes off a zebra. Because this is just part of their heart. So a memo trying to teach them how to act like they have sympathy simply doesn't. It works the same way for them as it would for a sociopath. But here's the irony to me. The people that are going to be hurt by this cutting 1.4 million jobs in this country, I mean, not cutting, but cutting access to a safety net for those people.
Right.
What's going to happen is not only is the economy losing $1 billion a week. I don't know if you saw that number. That's what this is costing the economy. But on top of that, you have Mitch McConnell, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, a bunch of Republicans who are really being hurt by it because under their supervision in their state, their employment picture is dismal.
Yeah,
what's your take on that?
Well, you know, in Kentucky, 4 out of every 1,000 people lost benefits, which has an 8.2% unemployment rate. And so McConnell and Rand Paul, like you say, are feeling the pressure. In Florida, you have 73,000 job seekers. They've lost on average about $230 a week, which, of course, is, like you say, there's a big multiplier effect. The best stimulus for the economy is to provide unemployment benefits for those people who are seeking work, aside from the fact that it's simply just the moral and right thing to do to help these people. And it also, you know, it helps the economy. And so there's no logic to it. They look like they're out of touch. And in fact, look, there's more and more commentators, there's more and more people who are writing about this, that this just looks like a naked attempt to sabotage the economy.
Sam,
and,
what do you
to
think?
Do it on the backs of these people who are already suffering.
What do you think of the CNBC pitch or the Fox News pitch? The Drudge Report kind of pitch, and that is, you know, damn it, these people are just lazy. This woman who has 3 children, she's just lazy. She, you know, she loves her life, and you know, it's really her fault. What is interesting is the numbers that we're seeing coming back in the polls are overwhelmingly against that idea. The average American now understands, no, a woman trying to support 3 children, working 2 jobs part-time, this is not the life that she wants. But this is nevertheless the pitch. If we force these people into starvation, then what's going to happen is miraculously they're going to find some way to add to our economy. That's the pitch we're hearing right now on Fox News,
right.
On this afternoon.
There's 2 reasons why people aren't believing it, and both of them have to do with the fact that it's simply not true. There's no data at all that shows that people who are on unemployment, it prevents them from getting work. In fact, all the research out there shows that when people are getting unemployment checks, it allows them to focus on getting work. It allows for them to pay the car payments so they can drive to the interviews. It allows for them to get dry cleaning if they want to get dressed for their work. It allows for them to provide child care so they can go out and interview and pound the pavement. And the other thing is that the American people just know it anecdotally. They're looking around. They know that there are 3 or 4 people looking for every job that's available. They know that what their neighbors are doing. They know what their friends or their cousins or their parents or their children are doing to look for work. And so this is falling on deaf ears, and the memo itself proves it. You know, that was a talking point that was working, that would be the headline of that memo. But instead,
well, okay, let me go to something that you've talked about before, and I think it's right on point here. You've always said, Sam, that the reason a memo like this, where you're trying to tell your rank and file in your party that you are losers, and you're losers because you don't have a heart. That's the heart of this thing. You're losers because you don't have a heart. You're losers because you don't know what empathy is. Let me teach you what empathy is. Now, what your position has been, and I agree with this, is that, you know what, Mitch McConnell doesn't really care. A Corn down in Texas doesn't really care. All they care about is their little area that they've been gerrymandered into. They're safe in that little area, and the only thing they're playing to is that gerrymandered crowd.
Yeah.
So your response, or my response, but might be, well, my God, is the Republican Party has become so dysfunctional? It's like trying to tell people how to eat. You know, when you sit down, don't eat with your hands. Okay. You know, pick up a utensil and use the utensil. That's what this memo is equivalent of. But your point has always been it doesn't make any difference. Well, let me hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I would say there's a variant on this because we do have, like I said, 16 Republican senators who are from states where there's simply a very high unemployment. But in the main, this is why it's going to have a problem in the House, because you've got Republicans who basically are playing to a higher and higher concentration of just red meat, right-wing extremist voters because of gerrymandering, because they're representing very narrow districts. I mean, just as a reminder, we know that Democrats in the Congress received 1.5 million more votes across the country than Republicans did in the last election for the House, yet the Republicans still control the House
Your position has been in the past, and my position too is the rank and file only care about what Corn is doing in their little corner of the world.
Oh, absolutely.
You see.
Absolutely.
Now, let me shift.
But here's where it's also going to hurt them because the fact is this is a national story. And Americans find this kind of behavior appalling. And nobody is buying the sales pitch that somehow the Democrats haven't offered any jobs proposals. I mean, there's been on the table for almost 2 years now from President Obama a $50 billion jobs proposal. There's only one thing that Washington can do to create jobs, and that is to spend money. And the Republicans refuse to do it. I mean, it's looking more and more like economic sabotage every day, and they're feeling the pressure.
Right. Okay. So real quick shift here. We've got about a minute left. What you're seeing here now is the argument, gee, we can't do this unless you can find a way to pay for it. Let me just tell you, that's the argument the Republicans are making. Yeah, we would do this if we had a way to pay for it. Truth is, if this was going to be a tax break for millionaires and billionaires, or if this was going to be money that was going to go to their big donor defense contractors,
yep,
they'd find a way, wouldn't
they? In fact,
let
me get more concrete. They're trying to pass a farm bill that is full of subsidies for big agriculture. They could save the money there if they were so concerned about it, but of course they're not. That's just a talking point.
Yeah. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Thank you, Sam. I'll be right back. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. Give me a call, 866-987-8466. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom. I'm taking your calls on the biggest stories today, 866-987-8466 or 866-745-2667. Let me go to one of the callers right now. Ron in Chicago. Are you there?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me? Hey,
yeah.
Just real quick, you know, if I have a real good year and I'm self-employed, I might gross $100,000. And I sat down and figured out one day that at $100,000 a year, it would take me 10,000 years to accumulate $1 billion. I mean, can you tell me, why do we as a society why do we even need billionaires? You know,
well, let me give you.
It's repulsive to me. I mean, what, you know, we could just get rid of the billionaires and the government would be in the black.
Isn't the real question, Ron, how much do you need to buy? I mean, really, how many jets do you need to own? How many vacation homes do you have to have? But I mean, it really comes down to it. It's really an odd, it's an odd mentality that the American public has. It's the Horatio Alger lie. And that is, gee, if I allow these billionaires to make more money, then it's going to be good for me because someday I'm going to be a billionaire or someday my child's going to be a billionaire. That's the lie that has been told. Now, how did they get there? Now, I want you to think about something. That lie doesn't just develop by itself. What you do is you focus the lie. You know, you have focus groups that you pay from all over the country, all over the world, in fact. The best analysis I can give you is we handled the tobacco litigation that settled years ago. And what we found was documents that said we have to figure out how to convince the American public that it's just fine for them to kill themselves. And the way that they did that was they came up with this idea of freedom. I need to have the freedom to kill myself if I want to do it. And you might remember the ads where people were out sitting on the, you know, the wings of airplanes. It's really an interesting, it's an interesting dialogue that we could find in these documents. And you can go online and find them. I don't know exactly where it is, but they're there. And you'll be amazed at how gullible the American public and the world public is, how it is that we can have them thinking, well, you know, I'm going to side with a billionaire because I'm going to be a billionaire. And the way they focused that, the way they sold the idea that, you know, by golly, we don't want to have a death tax because when we die, we're going to be taxed. Well, no, not really, because so few people in America even have the risk of being affected by the death tax. But they sucked everybody into that. So it's all watch Mad Men sometimes. It's about Madison Avenue, and it's about how, what a science this is. We work against these PR people all the time. Ogilvy is a great, you know, you talk about the dark, dark side of the PR business. Go look at the history of the Ogilvy firm. It's an international PR firm, and they are able to focus these ideas, and they say, look, if we can do it like this, we can sell the American public on this idea. Let me go to Chris in Vail, Colorado. Chris, are you there?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, this kind of is just kind of pretty simple question. It ties in with what you were saying. You know, if I can understand a wealthy, a rich guy being Republican because, you know, you can see they have their interests at heart, and I just don't understand how people who are struggling, or maybe not even struggling, but like barely getting by, it's like another lie, like that somehow all those people, like, you know, there's a lot of them that still vehemently defend the Republicans, where how do they think that they have any of their interests?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that again, Chris, that's been looked at too. I don't know if you've read Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas? But he draws on a lot of interesting stories and interesting studies in that book. And what he said, the analogy I like to use is this. How did wealthy, aristocratic landowners in the South that were, you know, growing cotton and soy, whatever they were growing, how did they get their sharecroppers to believe that the sharecropper had anything in common with this wealthy Southern aristocracy? How is it that they got that person to put on a torn up uniform and charge into a Union cannon knowing that their chances of survival was almost zero? And Thomas Frank would tell you, and everybody that's looked at it would tell you, that what they found is they found a reaction issue. And the reaction issue today may be race. Back then, it was this idea of religion. They actually had these people under their thumb in the Confederacy, where they would attend the local church and the preacher would say, God is on our side. The Union is the devil. And since God is on our side, you must do this to protect your family. So it all takes place in different ways. But the manipulative nature of good psychology, I don't mean good in a good sense. I mean of manipulative psychology is very effective. And that's another example of it. Wayne in Chicago, Illinois. You there, Wayne?
Yes. Let me cut the speakerphone down. So.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yes, I just want to say that, Mike Papantonio, you are the man.
Well, thanks. That's you, a big – I'm glad to sit here for Tom Hartman because he is he's – you know, let me tell you – let me go offline. I'll stay online here, but I want to tell you a quick story. There are people that moved into this business of what I'm doing here right now because of people like Tom Hartman and Ed Schultz and people who came before, you know, were out there long before anybody thought it was cool to be out there. And I hope every generation perpetuates that because Tom Hartman has been responsible for that. Wayne, I've got a minute. Tell me what you think.
Okay. I wanted to make two quick points. You only got a minute. First of all, we have to strike while the fire is hot. Okay, somebody like Rachel Maddow, for instance, could go back to all the way back to January 20 of 2009 when this present president got elected. Show people how many times the Republicans rejected
Oh, yeah.
Hoppe.
She did a great job with that. Wayne, it's a good talking point. I'll try to pick up on it, okay? I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman, 866-987-8466. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom. You know, there's absolutely no question that the banking giant J.P. Morgan knew that Bernie Madoff was ripping people off, and they did nothing to stop it because they made money in the way that Bernie Madoff ripped people off. In order to stop any further investigation, the bank did what they always do. They paid up another $2 billion, and Jamie Dimon, again, was not held accountable for anything. Nobody went to prison again. I have James Kaufman with me now. He's an attorney who's handled many, many of the biggest security cases in America. You know, James, let me ask you something. If I just – the list – see, I don't remember all of them. I can name a few, but I know you can name all of them. Give me the examples where banks have committed crimes, ranging from funding terrorists to laundering the money for criminals, and then a guy like and then nobody goes to jail.
Sure.
What's
sure.
the short list?
The short list. I'm just going to give you the J.P. Morgan list.
Okay.
Real quick. We could go all day if we talk about
let's
all
let's call
the
it
banks.
The Jamie Dimon J.P. Morgan
list. We're going to go with the Jamie Dimon list. Okay. First off, there's you talk about funding terrorists. $88 million they had to pay the Treasury Department because they conducted barred transactions with entities in Iran, Sudan, Cuba, and Liberia. They had to pay $5.2 billion for faulty foreclosure proceedings. They had to pay $110 million for stacking charges against their own customers on bank transactions to charge overdraft fees. They had to pay $296 million to the SEC for misleading investors on the quality of mortgage-backed securities, part of the mortgage crisis. A part of that, there's an unknown portion of $8.2 $5 billion in robo-signing on the foreclosure settlement. They were charged with a $1.5 billion fine in connection with the Jefferson County, Alabama bankruptcy, where they gave the county risky bonds, and it caused that county to go into bankruptcy. Biggest bankruptcy of any municipality until Detroit. And then we also have, most recently, we have $18 million for covering up the Bear Stearns problems when they acquired Bear Stearns. There's $920 million that was paid because of the London Whale transactions that cost billions and billions of dollars in customer money. And then recently we have $309 million that they paid in a fine for charging customers credit monitoring that simply just didn't exist.
Okay, we could go. Look, this is, understand, the numbers that you're reading, just so the listeners understand this and the viewers can see this, the numbers you're reading is just J.P. Morgan. This is not Goldman Sachs, and this is over the last couple of years. And in our Department of Justice, now here's where we really, rubber meets the road with this statement, has not put anybody in jail. It means anything. I mean,
could you imagine a criminal with this type of rap sheet?
Yeah,
an individual with this rap sheet?
Well, the difference between somebody going into a bank, handing somebody a note without a gun and say, "Give me your money"? That's what this organization, J.P. Morgan, has been able to do for a lot of years. And so the latest thing we see is a $2 billion settlement. This wasn't even on your list. J.P. Morgan Chase hands over $2 billion to close down the criminal investigation that showed that they knew exactly what Bernie Madoff was doing, that they were making money by Bernie Madoff stealing from charitable organizations all over the world, from people who could, you know, every description of investor. They made money if they allowed him to do it. And so, again, nobody is in handcuffs.
Nobody's going
to
jail.
No investigation by way of an indictment. No indictment here. What in the hell do we say about that? Now here's the real problem. This goes all the way to the top.
Yes.
I mean, you don't have a guy like Eric Holder say, "Oh, I don't know what's going on." He knows exactly what's going on. But if some cat's out there selling a 2-ounce baggie with marijuana in it, and he's done it several times, he's going to prison maybe for life in some places. You understand that,
yeah,
don't you? Life without parole.
And we do nothing. And this is supposed to be the U.S. banking system is supposed to be the on the front lines to prevent this type of fraud.
Tell us how. Give me your take on this case.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is a decade upon decade long relationship that J.P. Morgan had with Madoff. This goes back to the 80s. It goes back to the early 90s. And there were documents that have slowly come out that indicate that they knew as far back as, let's say, 1993, that what was going on with Madoff didn't pass the kosher test. There were some very significant issues. He kept hitting numbers years after year after year, and they knew internally this is too good to be true. That's what they would say internally. There's even a comment from a J.P. Morgan banker at this time that says, I think his accounting firm is probably a car wash.
Mm.
Now, keep in mind that...
No, we're talking about laundering money.
Laundering money.
Yeah.
He's laundering money. They're aware of it. And at the same time, they have investors who are saying, is my money safe with Madoff? You're supposed to give me advice. Is it safe there?
And you see, what people miss is the reason they came up with $2 billion was because they knew they were criminals.
That's right.
And wouldn't any criminal, if a criminal just robbed a bank and, you know, he had $100,000 and he's standing on the sidewalk, he says, "Oh my God, you caught me."
Yeah.
Wouldn't the criminal rather pay the $100,000 plus another fine than go to prison?
Well, yeah. And in this case, they're not even paying the $100,000 back to say that. It's $10,000. He's keeping $90,000 in his pocket.
Yeah.
In this scenario.
Okay. Let me go to another thing. This is startling to people. When Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs or any of the Wall Street thugs in the past have paid huge numbers like this, they use it as a tax write-off.
Yes,
taxpayers end up footing the bill here. And in this case, I think, and really it's because people have just started talking about it on programs just like this. The average American has no idea that when we catch Jamie Dimon being the thug that he is, And we say, Jamie, you got to pay another $2 billion along with the other money that you paid. They had no idea that Jamie Dimon, at the end of the year, was having taxpayers pay the money.
Yeah, he's going to take it as an offset on the $20 billion that he makes that year. So he's going to take the tax credit on the fine. He's going to make the money off of it as a, from a taxpayer standpoint. It's money that is robbing the American people of what Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan should pay in part of their taxes. He takes it as a tax incentive.
Okay, let me move a little bit to this. We, I guess people that follow what I do understand that what I do is handle, one thing that I do is I handle whistleblower cases from all over the country. In fact, we have them from all over the world. But whistleblowers call me and they say, I have these facts. And we're seeing it now more with the banking industry than ever. And so what we find is that a lot of times you will have a Jamie Dimon go ahead and try to beat the whistleblower to, you know, to the hit. They'll get out in front of it and say, you know, we know the whistleblower's coming out after us. We know we've been committing these crimes for years. So let's go ahead and turn ourselves in. He has no problem. He has no problem doing that because he knows he's not going to jail. He wears an damned Armani suit. You dress a guy up in an Armani suit and put a briefcase in his hand. He can steal a hell. He can steal a heck of a lot more than a man with a gun. So Jamie Dimon actually tries to nullify the whistleblower. We got about a minute. Yes. Tell me how many times you run into that.
Oh, we run into that all the time. And what will happen is that these, you know, Jamie Dimon's smart enough that he knows that if he comes clean and he says, well, not really clean all the way, but if he says, look,
Jamie
well,
Dimon will never be clean.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That he's going to say, look, mea culpa. We got a problem. Let me go ahead and pay this fine. He's going to go ahead and get – he robs it away from the person who could blow the whistle on him, and he can also point it on to something else. Oh, well, in this case, it's going to be, well, J.P. Morgan had faulty internal control.
Right.
There's going to be some internal person that he's going to blame it on.
Somebody else. And do it while Eric Holder is attorney general.
Yeah, and do it quickly. That's right.
866-987-8466. Follow me on Twitter, Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Mike Papantonio with James Kaufman. Thank you for joining me, okay?
Thanks, Bob.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Follow me at Twitter, Ring of Fire Radio, 866-987-8466. Let's talk. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom. Let's go to the callers. Thank you, by the way, all the callers that are holding. We've got a lot of topics we're talking about today. Mark in Ocala. Mark, you there?
Hey, Mike. How are you, brother?
Doing well.
I wanted to thank you. I talked to the call screener. I'm a Marine Corps combat engineer veteran, Desert Storm Platoon veteran, Marine Corps, and also United States Embassy Marine Guard from American Embassies, Honduras, and Argentina, Mike. And I thank you for what you do for working people. What's in your heart? You're a You represent, I'm from Abe Lincoln's hometown. I think you represent Abraham Lincoln values perfectly.
Well, that's a high compliment, Mark. I can tell you that. And let me thank you for what you do, too. You know, which brings me to a point. You know, the progressive movement is taking off more and more because I think that finally you have various parts of the movement that's feeling a kinship with one another. There was a time, I don't know whether you sound much younger than I am, but I remember a call. I remember a time when there was no continuity to the progressive movement. In other words, the people that were dealing with gender issues might not have anything to do with environmental issues, might not have anything to do with union issues. It might not have anything to do with women's rights issues. There was this disconnect. And I think what we learned was, you know, that we're kind of all in this together. So I appreciate the compliment. Did you have a question?
Well, Mike, I just, as a veteran and as a union carpenter, I just wanted to thank you for sticking up for working people. And I know it's not the gist of the show today, but I also did Operation Team Spirit in Korea. And I know Dennis Rodman went off the handle, but I also do defend him as a free American, being able to go where he wants. And I would prefer basketball over war in North Korea, so I would like to get your take on.
Well put. You know, most people, yeah, thanks. Most people scratch their head about Rodman and say, what in the hell? What is this about? I agree with, you know, the guy, he's an American. He has a right to travel where he wants to travel, has a right to say what he wants to say. And, you know, the freedom that we have is that we can be bizarre if we choose to be bizarre. If we feel like that some good comes out of it, great. But these people that are judging him, Dennis Rodman has always been judged. You know, but I totally agree with you on that. Jimmy in Newark, you there?
Yes, hello.
Go ahead.
All right, thanks for taking my call. One caller earlier, I just want to kind of expand on what they said about talking about how gullible the American people are.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if you heard about this, but there's this new sort of like social media, social engineering craze that's trending worldwide right now. It's called the Bikini Bridge. And what happened was a few people on some internet site, just for fun, decided to get this Bikini Bridge thing to become a worldwide trend. And what it is when a woman is thin enough, they lay supine on their back, and there's a little gap between their bikini bottoms and their abdomen. And now there are people going crazy on Twitter talking about how their daughters are going to develop eating disorders.
Yeah. Okay. Let me address it. I think I understand where you're headed with this. It's the selling of American ideas. I mean, that's kind of what we've been talking about before. And that is how easy it is to sell, the average American on an idea that Kim Kardashian is significant. An idea that Paris Hilton at one point in her life might have been significant for what reason, we're not sure. The idea that if we watch Honey Boo Boo, we're somehow going to benefit, I'm not quite sure, Ducks of Dynasty, how we're gonna benefit by understanding how average Americans live. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons that we rationalize why do we watch that stuff. But typically what we find is that there's real good explanations. I mean, the explanations are you're living in a generation that from the time you could open your eyes, from the time you could speak, you were interacting with a television. You are now interacting with a computer. And all of a sudden, it's like Aldous Huxley understood. I mean, that's what Aldous Huxley was writing about when he talked about something called Soma. If we take your attention away from things that matter, things that tell us that the damn earth is melting, things that tell us that racism is still alive and well, things that tell us that there's a class divide in America that stands the possibilities of dividing and actually demolishing democracy. These are things that we don't want to think about. We want to go home and we want to turn on the television and we want to see some mindless idiot discussion about who's going to be the bachelorette of the day. It's easier now because we have an entire generation that's all they've known. You have a part of the baby, call them Xers, call them millennials, you know, that those generations have been, you know, completely captivated by it. So have baby boomers. I mean, the end of the baby boomers. I remember, you know, the first time I saw Wizard of Oz and it hooked me. And then everything that came on that television set seemed to be significant to me, just like everything that seems to come out on a computer might be significant to this next generation. So, I mean, it's a trap. And unfortunately, we don't have an education system that makes us aware of that trap, that takes us away from that trap. The great classic writers used to say that we have to put blinders on sometimes to what's happening around us, and we have to pay attention to things that really matter. And so I think that's what we were talking about earlier, and that's what that Bikini Bridge is that whole Bikini Bridge issue is about, is how gullible have we become? How impressionable have we become? How is it that we're unable to stand in our own shoes and say, you know, this matters, this is ridiculous, I don't have time for this. That's where we've gotten to. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio or call me at 866-987-8466. Let's talk.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio or give me a call, 866-987-8466. I'll be back. Welcome back to Tom Hartman Program. I'm in for Tom today. My name's Mike Papantonio, and let's talk. Give me a call at 866-987-8466. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. You know, study after studies confirmed that our current Congress is one of the most dysfunctional in modern history, probably all of history. But while this gridlock's been a disaster for the middle class, the one percenters, man, they're loving Washington gridlock, aren't they? Joshua Holland is with me. Joshua, you there?
Hey, Pap. Happy New Year.
Doing well, thanks. Josh is he's senior digital producer for BillMoyers.com. Just an all-round brilliant writer, by the way, Josh. I mean, just keep turning it out every chance you get.
Thanks.
Give me your take on this. Your theory that Washington gridlock is great for the super rich. You know, we've been saying that a long time. I think you nailed it in this article.
Well, look, the system was set up by the founders, for better or worse, to be very conservative and unwieldy, right? It's a big ship that's hard to turn around. And there was a study that was published in November, and it found that when the more dysfunction that you see in Washington, the greater the share of national income goes to the top 1% once you have a certain amount of inequality in the system. And that's because inequality is self-reinforcing. You know, you see accumulated wealth buys political power. Political power buys rules that tilt the playing field in your direction that allows you to accumulate more wealth. And it really takes the will of Congress to go against that. So what there is there's this tendency that, you know, when there is gridlock, when there is dysfunction, the status quo tends to remain. So there's no way to really combat growing inequality. So that natural cycle, that self-reinforcing cycle, just continues to go on.
Okay, so essentially, you a do-nothing Congress, as you would describe it, it allows the wealthy to hold on to what they have. As a matter of fact, even take a bigger share of what they have. And if you look at the history, as you've pointed out here, the history shows that that's the case. I mean, anytime, I think you went between 1940 and 2006, you talked about in your article that a great article had been written, a great book and study had been prepared about that. And there were some very clear messages to that study. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, what they did was they looked at how much dysfunction there was in a variety of different measurements, right? They looked at where the ideological point where you could get 60 votes to overcome a filibuster was in any year. And throughout this 70-year period, you know, there's this very consistent pattern. The only exceptions are in the late 50s and in the early 60s, you see that this pattern doesn't hold. And I talked to one of the authors of the study, and I said, hey, if the status quo always kind of persists, then why doesn't the status quo persist in the late 50s and early 60s? And he said, look, inequality was low. And the reality is that when workers have a bigger share of the pie, they also have more opportunity to have their voices heard. And this was a time when you had much more, clout for labor unions, et cetera, et cetera. This was the only exception, this short period, a few years, late 50s and early 60s, the only exception to this pattern in the last 70 years. And it's interesting, I'll tell you one other thing, Pap. Two of the authors of this study did a study last year, and they found that the more Republican seats were held in Congress, the more wealth went to the top 1%. And I think these two things are connected, right? Because they get in there and they obstruct, and they slow everything down. They make sure that Congress can't get anything done that can help the, you know, the working majority.
Josh, I remember you did an article way back, maybe 3 years or longer than that, and we talked about the idea that that what was happening even before Obama even had a chance to get started was that you had congressmen meeting, you had, you know, the McConnells and the Boehners and the Republicans meeting and saying, our goal is to stop him from doing anything. Well, really what their goal was to do the bidding of the billionaire benefactors that kept them in business, because the billionaire benefactor, that Koch type, the Adelson type, the Trump type, they want a shutdown because they intuitively probably know exactly what you're talking about here, don't you think?
Yeah, those things are overlapping interests. They can sabotage the president. And of course, you know, they've slowed down the economy. These, you know, the Republicans have won on the big pictures of austerity. If you look at the overall government spending, it's been declining dramatically under Obama. And this is happening at the worst possible time, because this is, you know, we're in a period of continued persistent economic downturn. And it's caused by the fact that there isn't enough consumer demand in this economy. And, you know, this is just something that it's very difficult to get through to the other side, that this is the problem.
Joshua, don't you think that most of the obstructionists really don't care that the fact that, at end of 2013, that Congress only had a 12% positive view from the American public? They don't really care about that. What they care about is, what are my crazy, what are my lunatics in my backyard thinking? Because what they've done is they've gerrymandered crazy. You see, anytime you gerrymander crazy and you put all the crazy people in one place, then you're only playing to crazy. So what does the average congressman really care that their approval rating is only 12%? Because the crazies back home, they're going to reelect them anyway, aren't they?
You hit that on the head, Pap. And the other thing is that, you know, you always see the pattern where people say, we hate Congress, but we're going to reelect our congressman. So, you know, the ultimate goal of a politician is to get reelected. You have the pattern of increasingly concentrated Republican and Democratic districts where they don't have to worry about a general election. They just have to worry about a primary. And you have the reality that people who hate Congress often make an exception for their own congressman.
Okay, let's jump to another thing you've written about. I followed you a long time, as you know. When you used to talk about the idea that the Republicans' dream is to have no government. I mean, if we could just have basically anarchy for the 99%, that's fine, because the 1% is going to be behind the gates of a gated community. They're going to have their police. They're going to have their fire.
Well, they
going to have their
want
education.
Corporate subsidies.
Yeah.
You know, they want some government.
Yeah, they want some government. Okay, like. But this is the next best thing to no government, isn't it? If you can slow government down to a gridlock to where they don't actually do anything meaningful, it's kind of the next best thing to saying, yeah, we're gonna do away with government entirely. Not only have we discredited them, not only have we made the American people turn against government, the best thing we can do is we can't do away with it, but we can do the next best thing, and that is to close them down in effect.
It also helps them ideologically. Look, you have two different views of government. One side is saying, has a very consistent overarching narrative, that government is dysfunctional and can't do any good. When you get into power and you make that vision reality, you're reinforcing your own ideological, you know, perspective. And this is why I think Democrats are often outgunned when you have these standoffs over, you know, shutting down the government or whatever. Democrats, by and large, believe that there's an important role for good government, and it does not help their cause when government just doesn't work.
Isn't the other part of it, I think it's I call it the awakening years. It is Ted Kennedy, I remember, used to get on. He'd get on the floor and he would rail against Republicans when they did the kind of thing that they're trying to do right now with worker unemployed benefits. I mean, he would rail about it.
Yeah.
Now, but there was only Ted Kennedy at that point. I mean, there are a couple of other people. You know, at some point you had Tip O'Neill. He could do that. But then all of a sudden, it was almost as if you had what I call Birkenstock Democrats that moved into Washington. And the Birkenstock Democrats never believed that they should fight with the same ferocity that the other side was fighting. And the argument I would hear, you know, when I first started doing media, I've always been kind of take no prisoners. There's nothing warm and fuzzy about me. I'm the first to admit it. But the other thing I would hear, though, is can we really talk like that? Because when we talk like that, aren't we saying the same thing they're doing? And it's just such a nonsense argument to me. It's a ridiculous argument. Now we have this awakening where we have Bernie Sanders speaking up. We have Alan Grayson. We have Sherrod Brown. We have Elizabeth Warren. We've got these people that now are saying, you know, to hell with that. You know, we've been sitting here like a whack-a-mole where we just, you know, we play the role of whack-a-mole, and we have Republicans beating the hell out of us like we're whack-a-mole toys. And now it's time to speak up. Do you sense that might be going on right now?
I think that there's a divide, right? I mean, you know, you still have that kind of conciliatory, you know, let's reach across the aisle attitude in a lot of our lawmakers. But you're right. You're seeing the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, as Paul Wellstone used to say, really kind of finding its stride. And I think that, look, there are divides within the Democratic coalition that have been pretty much quieted by the Tea Party craziness. As we get into 2016, you know, one piece of conventional wisdom that I think is right is that you are going to see those old struggles between the Clintonian Democrats and the kind of New Deal Democrats.
Let's hope so. Joshua Holland, brilliant as usual. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much, Pap.
I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Or give me a call, 866-987-8466.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. Follow me at Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio or call me at 866-987-8466. I'll be back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio, or give me a call, 866-987-8466. Let me go to callers right now. Thank you, by the way. Callers are holding, and we appreciate that. We just have a lot of material to cover today. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. You still with us? Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Okay, let me go to James in Franklin, Tennessee. James, are you there? James in Franklin, Tennessee. Hey, how about Mary Ann in Fort Worth, Texas? Mary Ann, are you there?
Yes, my name is Marion.
Marion, okay.
Yeah, Marion Brown. All right. Okay, I have a beef about what's going on right now, too, you know, and I live in a very conservative state.
Really? Texas?
Yeah. Can you believe that?
You think?
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's like being on another planet.
It's around the, my friend, Marion, you're on the dark side of the moon. You're living on the damn dark side of the moon. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, as I stated before, I live in a very conservative state. Not only is the state conservative, that's not really what's bad enough. What's even worse is the fact that I live in Tarrant County, and I know you're not from Texas, and you probably don't know.
Isn't that where the bug killer, what's his name, the guy that the bug exterminator, isn't that his?
I forget his name.
Tom DeLay. That's.
And also Wendy Davis is from here, too.
Wow, what a contrast.
Yeah, it's weird. You know, I'd love to have a conversation with her. But
she must be like radioactive down there. What do you think?
It is. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm radioactive, you know, because I talk to a lot of people, you know, so mostly conservatives, you know, on jobs and whatnot. And, well, I talk to a lot of people who are liberal like me. I'm a staunch liberal. I don't believe in the death penalty. I don't believe in helping the rich all the time. I don't understand it. You know, why do they, Republicans, conservatives, Tea Partiers, always are down on the poor you know, even though some of them are poor. That was incredible to me.
Yeah. And, you know what? Hey, Marion, let me address, let's just talk. But I remember,
talk all day,
yeah, you remember Molly Ivins, of course. What a great treasure. She's written a couple. You ought to get them all. And then, of course, you got Jim Hightower down there. I mean, and you had Ann Richards. My guy, it's not like, let me tell you a quick story. I was there trying a case. Actually, in Houston, trying a case in 1992, in the middle of the trial, about a 2-month trial. I was asked to try the test case in a breast implant case, and I remember being in front of that jury. And I might have been my imagination, but I swear to you, it's almost like the week before the 92 election, where Karl Rove pushed in all the new judges, pushed in all the really, really crazy right. Before all that occurred, they were acting one way, and the day after, they were, that same jury was acting another way. And it's almost like a dark cloud settled over Texas at that point. That was the only way I could describe it. But to this day, I remember it. And every year, it seems like it's gotten crazier and crazier. I mean, how many times did you elect a guy like Rick Perry, for God's sake?
Well, you know what? If he ran again, they'd vote for him again.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right.
You know, it's amazing to me. Ann Richards was a good governor. You know.
Yeah, Ann Richards. Yeah, you know, the truth. Let me get this next caller, but let me close with Ann Richards. Ann Richards, the thing that, you know, she, a very good friend of mine who does, matter of fact, he does Free Speech TV with me. On our weekend show, Ring of Fire, Howard Nations is his name. He's a brilliant lawyer and just a brilliant political thinker. He actually talked to Ann Richards personally about the idea that when she was going and she was saying, look, I want to change the laws on handguns in Texas. Howard said to her, you know, why do you want to mess with that? It was George Bush running against her. Everybody recognized that George Bush had an IQ of about room temperature, and there was no way that he really would have prevailed except that big push that came with Ann Richards saying, look, I think I want to change the gun laws. Everybody told her not to. She did it anyway, and so I've heard Howard Nations tell that story so many times, and he says he remembers specifically talking to her and saying, look, this is a bad move. Let me go to Jay in Arcadia, California. Jay, are you there?
I'm here.
Go ahead.
Well, okay, I had a modest proposal, but I sort of want to give the background for it first.
A Jonathan Swift kind of modest proposal or what?
Kind of, yeah. I think we've gotten so used to the fact that you can send money to your president, your congressman, and your senator, and they'll do your bidding, particularly if they have enough money, that people aren't outraged enough by this sort of thing. And so here is my proposal. It would be that lawyers in any kind of civil case could contribute to the judge as much as they want, as often as they want, to help their client.
That's interesting, because basically we see that happening on Wall Street, don't we?
Happening in government.
We have Wall Street. We just had, matter of fact, James Kaufman on the air, and James Kaufman probably handles more big security cases than anybody in America. And he said he went through this list of 15 outrageous criminal cases that J.P. Morgan had been involved with, where there was no prosecution, but what they did was they paid their way out of it each time. And, you know, anytime you can pay your way out of crime, you're going to commit crime again. It's a culture of crime. And that's what we've created. And unfortunately, this president is partially responsible. He's understood that there was no way that he had an attorney general that was going to do anything about it. Just so you understand, you have an attorney general that came from a law firm called Covington & Burling. And Covington & Burling has always represented. These Wall Street thugs. I mean, they've made their money handling big time Wall Street criminals. So why would we think that this attorney general that comes from Covington Burling would do anything about what was going on? And so, I mean, it all goes to the top. There's no way you can say that some low level prosecutor with the Department of Justice is responsible for this culture of crime that's developed in America. You have to follow the money all the way to the top. And it goes to Covington Burling, that connection with our Attorney General. I'm Mike Papantonio. I'll be back. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Give me a call, 866-987-8466. Let's talk.
listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. You know, it's been 50 years to the day since LBJ first tackled the United States war on poverty. Great progress was made for decades until this trickle-down nut showed up in Washington, D.C., and convinced the American public that if you give billionaires more money, then the billionaire is going to share it with the American middle class. Joining me to talk about what a ridiculous idea that is Zoe Carpenter. She's a reporter for the nation's Washington, D.C. bureau, and very, very smart woman. Zoe, you know, how did we get sucked into this idea? I remember, we had in Philadelphia, Mississippi, you had Ronald Reagan show up. He was going to be the new savior for the American political scene. And the first thing he starts talking about is, you know, if we give billionaires more money, it's going to be good for all of us. Now, that was before your time. I think that was before your time. But I remember it. And so the media has sold that idea. We've bought into it. It's a lie, isn't it?
Well, I think we've seen pretty good evidence of that, certainly in the last decade and with the recession. But that idea that, you know, freeing the job creators to create jobs will create prosperity for everyone is persistent and I think effective. It has been effective in some cases.
And it's created poverty in the United States. And your article in The Nation that tells us that there's this majority that want government to fight poverty. They don't want private institutions or private industry or corporatists to come in and try to do anything about poverty, right?
Yeah, it was the results of this study were pretty overwhelmingly positive towards the idea that government has a responsibility to use its resources to do something about poverty. And the policies that received at least 80% total support from across the political perspective spectrum included things like universal child care, nutrition assistance, publicly funded scholarships for higher education, and raising the minimum wage. And those are proposals that are on the table, both at the local level and in some cases nationally.
You know, I was so interested in your article, especially juxtaposed with this garbage that you had House Republican Conference come out. I couldn't make this up. That's why I have to put it in front of the camera. But this document was where they sent this document to their rank and file Republican, and they said, you know what, this is going to tell you how to look like you have sympathy and compassion for the American worker. Doesn't mean you really have to, but if you'll follow our step-by-step how to look human instructions here, you might actually look human. Now, that is the interesting thing to me about that is that the American public, according to what you write and according to the studies that are shown, the American public is so out of sync with this kind of garbage.
Right. Well, I think that we are seeing a rhetorical shift in the Republican Party away from demonizing the poor and people who are struggling, but that's not necessarily corresponding with a shift in policies. We're still seeing conservatives advocate for the same kind of anti-government, anti-safety net priorities that have hurt a lot of people. And it's true that the safety net is not sufficient to tackle the crisis of poverty and unemployment in the country, but it's certainly necessary.
Yeah. Okay, so the numbers, I don't think there's anything equivocal about the numbers. A whopping 86% agreed that government should use its resources to fight poverty. There's nothing equivocal about that to me. I mean, that number is staggering.
Mm-hmm.
And 61%, according to your article and according to the study, said that the war on poverty has made positive differences. The thing that's not talked about, Zoe, and I want to know what your take on it, is when LBJ came out with his war on poverty, I mean, if you think about it, the narrative was we're doing this because we think that the least of our society, that our neighbor that can't feed his family, that can't afford clothes, that doesn't have housing, that we have a moral obligation to take care of that neighbor. Now, that was the easy part. But what we missed was that you had economic advisors telling LBJ it's about far more than that. Because if you power the bottom of our economy, if you give the least of our, our working poor, if you give them money, they're going to go out and spend the money by buying food and by buying clothing and by taking care of themselves. And the money is injected right back into the economy immediately. And so what I think is so important is LBJ understood that when he came forward with this, and there's been a benefit, as 61% of the American public says, that the war on poverty has not only had that moral benefit, it's had an economic benefit too, hasn't it?
Right, that's certainly true, and that's an argument for extending long-term unemployment benefits, is that money gets spent pretty much immediately, so it's a sure economic infusion right there. Someone who's working a low-wage part-time job at McDonald's is much more likely to end up using food stamps or using other forms of federal benefits. And if their wages were higher and they had access to full-time employment, maybe that wouldn't be the case. So there are lots of arguments, economic arguments, not just moral arguments for these kinds of programs.
Well, let me say, the image of the welfare queen still lives on, doesn't it? I mean, if you had Roger, Lee Atwater, you had Lee Atwater invented the idea that if we scare the hell out of the American public and tell them that all of your tax money is going to the welfare queen, as they put it, then it's going to scare them to the point to where they're going to say, damn it, let's do something about it. The truth is, when you analyze this, wouldn't you rather give the money to the people that, at some point they may take advantage of the system, but how do they possibly take more advantage of the system than the thugs and the criminals dressed in Armani suits wearing Rolex watches in on Wall Street? That's the real crime center. That's the real crime enterprise. So how is it that we're saying, no, we can't take any chances that our tax money might be wasted on this welfare queen, but we can give these gazillionaire thugs on Wall Street, the Jamie Dimon types, we can give them our money and everything's going to be okay, even though they stole, $13 trillion from us the last time? It's almost like the progressives have not wordsmithed this very well, and the crazy right has done a pretty good job of it. What's your take on it?
Well, there's still something very powerful, unfortunately, I think, about those ideological stereotypes about the welfare queen, about revenue, about taxes, how we can use tax money. That really plays into the conservatives' advantage. One thing that was interesting about this study was that, well, you're right, that the majority of the respondents did say that they believed poor Americans abuse government programs. There was still overwhelming support for government programs. So, there's this sort of inconsistency between the power that these very broad overgeneralizations have but the fact that people do actually believe that universal pre-K and increasing the minimum wage are important things and should still be done.
Yeah, I mean, what is your take? What is that disconnect, though, that, I was raised in the South, down South, middle Florida, where it's anything but blue down there. It's not even purple. Hell, it's bright red. Always has been. And the talking point always was, it scares me to give money to people who don't deserve it. How do you possibly justify Wall Street deserved $13 trillion that they during a time when we didn't have it, but we gave it to them anyway. The disconnect is amazing to me. The American public can't pick it up. What's your quick take on that, about 30 seconds?
Well, I don't think you can justify that, and there are plenty of other examples, tax breaks for oil companies, for example. And confronting those inconsistencies is a problem not just for conservatives, but also for the Democratic Party when it comes to Wall Street, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I wish they'd speak up, but now we have the modern Wall Street Democrat that is not recognizable as a Democrat. 866-987-8466. Thank you, Zoe, for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Mike Papantonio. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio sitting in for Tom. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be back. Welcome back to Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio sitting in for Tom, the medical profession. Let's shift gears.
Wow.
They've become an extension of big drug, big pharma. Rather than fixing problems or even preventing them, they're trained to push as many pills as possible. Joining me now to talk about the problem is Dr. Tom Schneider. He's been on our Ring of Fire program before. Everybody wants to talk to Tom because he takes such a different attitude. Hugely, hugely qualified doctor, certified in virtually everything you'd want him to be certified in. Years and years of experience, and I just love talking to Tom because he puts such an interesting spin to what's going on out there. He wrote a book called A Physician's Apology. You really ought to get the book. I think you can get it on Amazon, and it's called Physician's Apology. You can get it right here on our site, Ring of Fire Radio, if you go to our site. I urge you to get this book. Go to Ring of Fire Radio, buy this book right off of our site through Amazon, and you're going to love this book. Tom, listen, if we take a look at the state of the world with Big Pharma calling all the shots, it scares the hell out of me as an attorney because I see the other side of it. I see how dishonest this industry has become, corrupt in every way. What's your take? I mean, I don't want to overstate it. Is that an overstatement?
No, I think it's an understatement, Mike, and thanks so much for having me. I love it. I love being here. Big Pharma, to me, there's two sides. There's the double-edged sword. The one sword is that we put it down, got to put Big Pharma down. The other side is that it does have an aspect of help. I take medications. The problem is the facts. We don't give out the truth or the facts or the information to the consumer to be able to protect himself. And I'm going to tell you, as you know this fact, we've talked about it, how many people did we kill last year? We, physicians, giving medications out.
Yeah, put that in terms of, say, a nuclear blast.
Right, right. So I give the example of a 747 carries 300 people, and if I told you that they literally lost 30 of them last year, you know, or 300 of them last year, would you sit there and go, I think I'll walk to California. I don't want to take the 747. So that's effectively what we did. We killed 100,000 people last year, and we've done that for the last 10 years. Now, that's kill. We've maimed or injured over a million.
Well, when you say maim, you're talking about the drug industry here, and you are somebody who is spoken out about the drug industry. Let me go through the problems that after reading your book, and by the way, Tom, it is so well done. And you're talking to somebody who confronts the drug industry every day.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, I'm taking a deposition this week and next week and the week after that on these national cases against this drug industry. Now, here you have the thing that I've seen developed, and I guess you've watched it develop, is the creation of the biostitute. The biostitute is the scientist who will say anything you want them to say for the pharmaceutical industry for the right amount of money. And you can find them in any university.
Yeah.
They're paid a couple hundred thousand dollars in the university to be a biostitute for somebody like Merck or Pfizer or Glaxo. Hell, they make $500,000.
Yeah.
So tell me the impact of the biostitute.
So it's huge because, unfortunately, what we deal with on a practical level is the average physician, the guy that gets up and the gal that gets up in the morning, goes into the office, and may and probably does want to do the best for their patient. They absolutely do. That's not who we're talking about. We're talking about the scientist physician or the associated scientist physician with the university who is, exactly as you've said, being paid for a particular study or, more importantly, let me put it to you this way, a particular result. Mm. And that information doesn't get down to the busy get-up-in-the-morning physician who's going in to see 30 patients. He takes the word of the pharmaceutical rep, who's usually cute, was a cheerleader at University of North Carolina, and
has cupcakes for him, right? Doc, here's the cupcakes. Let me don't even worry about the right. all the bad stuff with this drug. Just eat the cupcake, and life is going to be good. Now, let me shift to something else. I took a series of depositions in Europe a couple of months ago on a case that I'll be trying this year, Pradaxa, which is a blood thinner that's killing people by the hundreds.
Oh yeah.
It's produced by a company called Boehring Ingelheim over in Germany.
Yes.
And now we're seeing more and more of that, European countries coming over here to the U.S., A, because they can sell their product for more money in the United States, and B, they can kill people and get away with it because the FDA is so dysfunctional. But what I saw in that deposition was that the company, and we see this very often, you'll see a company make a determination of how many people they can kill and still make a profit.
No, that's absolutely
true. In other words, if they're selling $10 billion worth of the product a year, they can sell, in 1 year they can pay off all the dead people for, $1 billion, and they've made $9 billion. And when you don't throw them in jail for that, life goes on. Isn't that kind of, do you see that firsthand?
Absolutely. And, things are going to happen, but I am not the angry physician yelling out. I'm also the patient. I don't think there's a listener out there that's had as many diseases as I have, and I'm not proud of that, but I've had them all. And, for example, I took an NSAID, something that anybody else would take, a Motrin, a Celebrex. Years ago when I was running, I took one. And it perforated my intestine, and I spent 3 months in an ICU from a perforated bowel. Hmm. Now, this medication has been known to do that before, and when the representatives came to me, they said, well, we have to have a certain amount of failure. Some people are going to bleed. Some people are going to die. And I said to them, what's an acceptable number? And they said, about 30 per 100,000. What do you think of that? And I said, I think one is too many.
Hey, Tom, can you stay with me? Do you have time to stay with me? Because we just scratched the surface on this. When we come back, I want to continue this discussion with Dr. Snyder. His book, it's a must-read, Physician's Apology. Go to Ring of Fire Radio, look at our site, go to the, you'll be able to order right off the site. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. 866-987-8466. Give me a call. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. We got a quick break. I'll be back with Tom Snyder. Dr. Tom Snyder talking about Physician Apology, his new book. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. If I were to list the short list of the top thugs in this country, you'd have Wall Street, and then you'd have the drug industry. I just can't tell you that right now this is a topic you need to know about, and it's so important because if you're taking a drug now that hasn't been on the market for more than 10 years, You got some questions that you ought to be asking yourself. I have Dr. Snyder, Dr. Tom Snyder, with me now. He's written a great book about this, Physician's Apology. It is just very important reading. If you take any kind of medication at all, you need to read this book. You can get it on Amazon. Go through our site at Ring of Fire Radio. You can get it there. But anyway, look, Tom, Dr. Snyder, let me just ask you this. There was a time when a CEO used to stay with a drug company they'd be there 25 years. They'd start their career there and they'd end their career there. Now what you have is a process called big profits, big risks. And the CEO is going to be there for 5 years. They're going to move through. They're going to take and extract everything they can from that drug company. And they're going to take their profits, take their big bonuses in 5 years, and they're going to go home and leave all the death and all the destruction to the next CEO. Don't you see that? As a matter of fact, you touched a little bit about that same or similar topic in your book. What's your thought?
No, I couldn't agree more, Mike. You're so on. And it really does come down to the bucks. So you've got a major pharmaceutical company that has a drug, and they are going to push it. And they're going to push it with very attractive pharmaceutical reps to the local doc. No offense to the male pharmaceutical reps that are out there, but that's what we're seen by. And the book, A Physician's Apology, is really meant as an instruction guide for patients to say, listen, if you go to see your physician and all you leave with is a prescription, find another doctor. Because although you and I are talking about pharma, Mike, and I fully understand that, we have to also at least infringe on the physician's part here. Because physicians today are taught, make a diagnosis and give the medication that's required for it. And that's obviously, you know better than I, not the way to do it.
But there's so many parts to this. You know what a good example is your discussion about statins.
Oh, yeah.
Now, okay, so we see this report come out 4 or 5 years ago. We've got to lower cholesterol below 200 to now, you know, the number then became 160. You got to get lower than that. Then the next thing we find out is that women that have a cholesterol level below 200 were at a higher cardiac risk.
Correct.
Then we find out that not only is that bad, we find out that statins basically are poisoning people, and you don't have any discussion that starts really surfacing in the important journals because the pharmaceutical industry controls the journals too, don't they?
They absolutely do, and your topic of the statin is so poignant because, in fact, I tell patients, if you're being given a statin, or really this applies to any medication, but particularly a statin, you need to ask your physician, what's it going to do for me? Well, it's going to lower your cholesterol under 200. Is there a study that says that's worthwhile? And the answer is no. There are lots of studies, but are there valid studies? And the answer is no. The total cholesterol is not a factor. I tell my patients, what kind of fat is cholesterol? Is it good or bad? They go, oh, I think it's both. No, it's not even a fat. Cholesterol is not a fat. It is choline, liver, steroid. It's what makes your testosterone, progesterone. So you lower that, and you're going to lower your testosterone, your estrogen, your progesterone, and you're also going to have to say or should be saying to your physician, what are the side effects here?
Well, okay, then here's the real problem, one of the very many real problems, but it is that when we take a drug, we believe the FDA has done testing on it.
Right.
Okay, the FDA has not tested it at all.
No.
Most of the time, the FDA doesn't even know what the hell's going on until the drug, 3 years later, starts killing people by the thousands. I tell you that firsthand. It is absolutely the truth because I handle these cases. Now, what they did, I've seen study after study, where they go in and they find out how influenced has the FDA been to lie? How influenced has the FDA been to cover up clinical data that was all bad for a particular drug and then say we're going to sell the drug anyway? 61% of respondents in one survey that knew cases, directly knew cases, where the Department of Health and Human Services and the FDA or the FDA had political appointees that inappropriately put themselves into the FDA determination as to whether or not the drug should stay on the market or be granted on the market. All that is it's money.
It's all money.
You have a politician calling, putting pressure on somebody in the FDA, or somebody in the FDA is going to go get a job for Merck. From Merck or Pfizer. You have Pfizer meeting with the FDA folks all the time, talking to them all the time, saying, you know, Joe, how would you like to come to work and make an extra $300,000 a year when you come to work with us? How do we have any confidence in the FDA?
No, I have none. And what's scary is, I mentioned this because we have listeners out there that this applies to at our level. Never mind the university researchers at our level. And I would venture to bet that there isn't a single listener right now that's on a statin, that's a cholesterol-lowering medicine, a Lipitor, a Crestor, or any of the other names that are down there, Prevacol. There isn't a single one that when they were given that drug by their physician was told, Your risks from this medication are diabetes type 2, increased risk of breast cancer for women, increased risk of prostate cancer for men, and 85% of you will have cognitive delay. You'll be walking around in a fog. But please take it because I need your cholesterol under 200. And, oh, by the way, we have no studies that that's going to save your life.
How it's almost like a mania, isn't it? A report comes out and says, gee, take the statin. It's going to save your life. That's followed up by a slick ad campaign by Madison Avenue hustlers that make you believe that if you don't take the statin, you're going to be dead tomorrow. And then all of a sudden, it's almost as if overnight, statin is the new black.
Absolutely. I mean, there was a study about 6 months ago that said we need to be giving these to children.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Children.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, the cases that I've handled, of course, as you know, I handled the FinFin litigation. We handled we actually led that discovery in that. Fioxx, the same thing. We actually led the discovery with that. We're doing the same thing with half a dozen other drugs, right? Whether it's Actos, whether it's transvaginal mesh, whether it's Pradaxa, we see the same story every single time. And that is the drug company doesn't really care whether or not they stay on the market after the point that they've made a big profit. And here's what they know. Once the FDA allows them to sell the product, the chances of having that product pulled from the market is less than 10%.
Oh, yeah.
So they know that, look, we'll lie, we'll phony up clinicals, we'll do everything we can to distort the truth up front. Then when our product gets on the market, it's going to be very difficult for them to pull a product like Pradaxa, for example, or Actos, for example. It's going to be very difficult for them to pull it. Mm-hmm. And we see that happening right now. I see it all the time.
But it's not just the person that's listening right now, not our listener. It's everyone. So I'm a physician. I'm boarded in 5 specialties, and I also am diabetic. My physician convinced me about a year and a half ago that Victoza, and I'm not putting down one particular drug, but this is the truth, Victoza, a brand new medication better than insulin, would work wonderfully. And I did, and I took it. It turns out that Victoza has a side effect. It causes pancreatitis and hepatitis. And so, as you know, from January until May of this past year, I spent in an ICU having intra-abdominal surgery, intravenous medications to try and quiet this down.
Well, isn't the thing, I mean, at the very least, we should give people a choice. We
absolutely.
We should say, look, here are the facts.
Yeah.
If you take this, you might get pancreatitis, you might get liver cancer, you might, you know, you may have a DVT, a blood clot, you may, but here it is. Matter of fact, as you know, we handled the Yaz case. That was the case that killed so many women in America. Yaz was a birth control pill that you had Bayer Corporation selling it as something far beyond a birth control pill. They were doing something called off-label marketing where they sold it to women telling that if you take, and all it was a birth control, but if you take this birth control, it's going to cure your acne, it's going to solve your PMS problems, and we are the birth control with extra. What they didn't tell women was if you take this birth control, you have a 60% higher risk than the normal person taking competitive birth controls for dying from a blood clot.
Absolutely. And the marketing for that was so good, I wanted to take Yaz. I mean, it's that
well,
good.
Yeah, I mean, but we see it repeatedly. This is a story that repeats itself time and time again because there are no adults running the program with the FDA.
And it would be nice if we could demand that for each drug that comes out or each drug that's given to you or me as a patient has what I call an RB ratio, a risk to benefit ratio. Tell me what the risks are. Tell me exactly what they are. And tell me what the benefit is again. I want to know that. Now, if you do that to most of the medications that are out there right now, you would take nothing. Risk to benefit ratio, very, very important. What's the risk of a statin? Oh, my God. What's the benefit? Minimal.
What about my advice that I give people? Don't take it unless it's been out there for 10 years.
Oh, the best ever. Anything under 10 years is crazy.
And then once you have taken it, don't just listen to your doctor. Go online, find the information.
Research.
For yourself.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Tom Snyder wrote a great book, Physician's Apology. It's just so well done. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm Mike Papantonio. Hartman. I'll be back. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom. Look, first of all, I want to apologize. Callers, this lines have been crazy busy. We're trying to get to them. I'm going to get to them right now. Let me go. Ed in Burlington, New Jersey. You there?
Yes. Good afternoon, Mike.
How are you?
Good. You spoke earlier regarding a law firm, Covington and Burling, in Washington.
Yes.
And I've gotten a couple emails over the past couple of weeks from them with, like, a case number scheduled to appear, and there's an attachment that comes through, and my my Windows software won't let me open it. It says it's infected with a virus.
Yeah, well, I was talking about them because Eric Holder, who is the Attorney General, of course, of the United States, comes from that firm. And we were the discussion was that it was interesting to me, and it's interesting to everybody who talks about it. It's just not a Mike Papantonio issue. The number of crimes that have taken place on Wall Street are just, we've lost count of them. If you heard James Kaufman, who was on with us, he went through a string of 15 major multi-million, some billion dollar crimes, of 15 of them, I think, that was just J.P. Morgan. And I said, well, how many have been prosecuted where anybody went to jail? In that, there were zero. And so the point being, it all flows from the top, Ed. The guy at the top is Eric Holder, and Eric Holder says, I don't want to prosecute white collar criminals. The real question is, does it go all the way to Obama? But the point is, I don't want to prosecute white collar criminals. I would rather prosecute some cat who's, you know, sold drugs, you know, he sold marijuana four or five times, got caught. Now he's life in prison. So that's the new focus. The new focus is the standard. If you wear an Armani suit and you have a Rolex watch and you drive a Bentley and you live on Wall Street, then you're held to a different standard of crime. And this is an attorney general that has made that a culture where the crime is repeated again and again, because why not? If Jamie Dimon can run an organization that steals billions of dollars or hustles people out of money by the billions and nobody goes to jail, well, it's just a cost of doing business. And then at the end of it, this is what's really interesting, Ed. At the end of it, after they have to pay the fine, maybe it's $900 million, taxpayers are the people who end up paying for it because they take it as a write-off at the end of the year. So it's the ugliest, most vulgar. It is the most vulgar process that I can ever remember seeing happen in America. Look, Ronald Reagan, for God's sakes, put 800 bankers in prison for the SNL crisis. You know how many have gone to prison for the mortgage crisis off of Wall Street? $18 trillion, 13 to 18 trillion, depending on how you analyze it, stolen from the American public. Zero. Zero people have gone to prison. Now, add to that, it's not that zero people have gone to prison. There have been zero indictments. A U.S. attorney can always get an indictment. All they have to do is walk in there, present the facts. They're going to get an indictment. There's no problem getting an indictment. You simply have Covington Burling, that this Eric Holder comes from. It's just part of their culture. They defend these people. This is how they make their money. And this is how Eric Holder came up. So there's no surprises, the point I was trying to make here. Let me go to Jan in Snowflake, Arizona. Jan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for holding, by the way. I know people have been holding a long time. The Green Democrats just tweeted me and said, you know, I was on hold for an hour. I'm so sorry.
Mike, I'm assuming that Hillary Clinton is part of the Clinton Initiative.
Oh, yeah.
And because of that, the Clinton Initiative is online for putting 40,000 fracking wells around the world.
Oh, yeah.
And I, for that reason alone, will not vote for Hillary Clinton.
Well, let me give you another reason. I could go on for the reasons. Look, it was Bill Clinton that gave us NAFTA. Okay, he invented NAFTA, he invented CAFTA, he put it on the table telling us this was going to be great for America. In the end, it bankrupted this country in so many ways. It bankrupted the manufacturing industry, it bankrupted our job supply. I mean, we're sending jobs by the gazillions overseas. It's hurt us in so many ways that we don't even have sovereignty anymore. A foreign corporation can come to America and say, you know, we don't like your environmental laws anymore. So they sue us in court to change our environmental laws. We don't like your regulations on how we're supposed to treat workers. So they sue the American government for that. Now, you have a president right now, President Obama, who wants to take CAFTA and NAFTA and put it on steroids with TPP. If Hillary Clinton is elected, it is going to be a done deal. I think TPP can help be held back this time. I think we can stop it in its tracks. If Hillary Clinton is elected, you're going to have TPP that's going to sail through, and you're going to have an America that you don't even recognize anymore. It's going to look like it's part of the damned EU with getting all the bad parts of the EU. They're going to create a Saipan right here in America where there are no regulations on safety for the workers. There is no right for a person to organize a union and aggressively go after their rights and protect their rights. There is no regulation that's going to protect our environment that you don't see tested by way of the TPP. And we're already seeing it with NAFTA. In NAFTA, you're already seeing them sue Canadian companies in Quebec because Canadian companies don't want drilling and they don't want fracking. I mean, communities up there. So the company sues them. Last suit was for $250 million. Look, this has been fun. I'm Mike Papantonio. It's been in for Tom Hartman. It is where you need to come every day to get the backstory of what's really happening in America. And the truth is, if you can't get the news here, you're just not going to get it. Follow me on Twitter. I'm Mike Papantonio. Follow me at Ring of Fire Radio. Continue this conversation with me. It's been fun. Thank you.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. Solar World has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.